Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
We're continuing with our overview of the book of Shmos, from exile to redemption. We're coming in on the end. I'm guessing we'll have, including today, there'll be three more classes till we finish the book of Shmos. To recap, Sefer Shmos has 11 Torah portions. Right, by now we should know most of them, right?
Yeah.
It's divided into three parts. The first part is the actual exodus from Egypt. Those are the first four Torah portions. The next two Torah portions, Yisro Mishpatim, is the giving of the Torah at Sinai, the two versions of it, and the giving of civil laws. Now, even though we spent, I believe, 15 classes on the first six parshas, we're only going to spend three on the last five. And not doing it justice, but that's how we're going to do it. And the last five, which is Truma, Tetzave, Kisisa, Vayakel, and Pekude. The last five is one topic, and that topic is the instructions and the construction of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle. That's the discussion. So today we're going to discuss the tabernacle, and next week we're going to speak about the garments of the priests, and then we're going to speak about the sin of the golden calf. Those are the three classes to wrap it up, so to speak. So, there's a lot of issues that we've got to understand. First of all, just so we know what we're talking about, the sheet with the pictures here, there's different, there's better books that are, you can buy that have beautiful pictures of it. But this is the general layout of the Mishkan. The general layout of the Mishkan was, first of all, it was a portable sanctuary that could be taken apart and put together. If you look at either the left or the right picture, they give you the same idea. The right one, so each one's a little, well, really like this. Start with the further right-hand picture. The further right-hand picture, that schematic that shows you is the outer courtyard, that rectangle, is the outer courtyard, which distance was 150 feet long by 75 feet wide, which is 150 feet long is one half the size of a football field, an American football field, not Canadian. So you picture in your mind a football field, half of that long, and I think 75 feet wide is about how wide a football field is. I'm not sure exactly. So about half a football field, that is the entire courtyard area, and the outside was with curtains, wooden poles and curtains connecting them. So that area in general, the courtyard, you see on the lower part, there was an entrance into the courtyard. And when you came into the courtyard, the first thing you saw directly ahead of you was the altar and the ramp going up to the altar. The altar is where all the animal sacrifices took place. Then, further ahead, you see the rectangular construction of the Mishkan itself. It's very blurred, so now go to the middle picture. The middle and the left give you a little schematics. If you go to the far left, it gives you the order. Now you're already in the tabernacle per se. In the tabernacle per se. And the tabernacle itself, you see, was made out of various boards, and each board was 1.5 cubits, which is about 2 odd feet or so, 2 1/4 feet. And you see that there was an entranceway, a curtain into the tabernacle, the Mishkan, and straight ahead was an incense altar where they would put incense and burn them. Then to your right was the table where the showbreads were put in every Friday. 12 challahs were put in by the Kohanim and taken out every Friday. To the left is the menorah, and straight ahead was the curtain that got you now to the holiest of holies, and that was the ark that had poles connected to it, and inside the ark were the Ten Commandments. Okay, we got the general idea of the construction there. This is what was they were commanded after they received the Torah at Sinai, to build a Mishkan. Okay, and that Mishkan lasted a long time. It lasted from the Exodus. It was built 1 year after the Exodus. That would be in the year 2449 of world history. And that lasted until the temple was built. And that was a period, if I'm not mistaken, 480 years. It's about how long it lasted. Approximately. Maybe I'm off a few. Something that sounds like that. It's more than 400 years. More than 400 years. They had this tabernacle. And the Torah goes into great detail describing the building of this thing. Great detail. So the first thing we have to understand is that what happened once the Jewish people settled in Israel and King David established the kingdom of Jerusalem, so King Solomon built a permanent temple. Built the Beis HaMikdash, which had many similarities, and some of the same utensils were used, but it was a permanent structure. So the first question I have to ask is, why is the Torah going into so much detail describing something that was only a temporary thing? It was only a temporary thing. It may make more sense to discuss the Beis HaMikdash, which lasted in Jewish history. It's where we're supposed to have a Beis HaMikdash. We had two Beis HaMikdashes, and they lasted 830 years combined. And when Mashiach comes, we'll have another Beis HaMikdash. So why is there any discussion of that in the Torah? Really, there's no discussion, just of the Mishkan, nothing else. So that needs some analysis. And we have to understand what is the significance of this Mishkan, why we have it, etc., etc. So let's begin our discussion. If you're looking at the other sheet that I gave you. Now this parsha, Truma, so we're going to merge these parshas. Basically what you have, Truma parsha is discussing all these items, the construction of the building and the utensils. There's one not in this parsha, next parsha. Next parsha, Tetzava, is a description of all the garments that the priests wore, generally speaking. Then there's this Kisisa becomes a recommandment of it, briefly. Then it's interrupted with a story of the sin of the golden calf. That's the next, the parsha of that Kisisa. And then we come back to the discussion of building of the Beis HaMikdash. And then the last two, of the Mishkan, and then the last two parshas, Vayakel, describes the exact, the actual building of the Mishkan, and Pekudei, the actual making the garments for the Kohanim, and that finally the Divine Presence entered the Mishkan and the Jewish people's destiny had been fulfilled. That's the overview. That's what these last five parshas are all about. And as we know, Ramban told us, we learned the famous Ramban, that why is this included in the book of exile and redemption? Right? And he says, redemption is only when you get back to the place where your patriarchs originally were. And where is that? When the Divine Presence was resting in their homes. And therefore, we're not truly redeemed until the Divine Presence is resting back amongst us. And that happened with the building of the Mishkan. Okay, that's just an understanding of where its place fits in to the storyline and to the place in Torah. Once we have the Mishkan, then all kinds of things can happen. Now, when we get to the book of Vayikra, I hope one day I'll have the guts to want to do a series on Vayikra. It's much more challenging to do those parshas with the Korbanos. It's much more difficult. It needs a lot more study and to really be able to present it in a user-friendly way. But that is really the work that we do. We bring Korbanos, we bring offerings to God. And how that all fits in is a discussion for another time. But without the temple, there's nothing we can do. So, let us first discuss what was the function of this Mishkan. What was the function of this Mishkan? So I'll draw your attention to the sheet over here with a couple sources. And there will seem to be a bit of a conflict, a major conflict in the commentaries over here. If you look in the second and third source, the Seforno, which is a commentary about 500 years ago. He says like this, on the commandment that God says you should make a sanctuary. He says, and so you shall make the sanctuary in order that I should dwell among you to speak with you and to accept the prayer and service of Israel. This is not as it was before the sin of the golden calf. where it was stated when we got the Torah at Sinai, shortly afterwards, before we sin, it says, in any place where I shall have my name mentioned, I shall come to you and bless you. Which seems to suggest that before we sinned, there was no need of a sanctuary. There was no need of a sanctuary. You could talk to God everywhere. And in the next source, number 3, it says a sanctuary had to be made, and the Torah makes it clear that this happened as a result of Israel's evil choice. For at the end of the first 40 days, God gave the tablets made by himself to sanctify them all as priests and holy nation as he had promised, but they rebelled and became corrupt and fell from their high spiritual level. So says the Sephorno, the purpose of the sanctuary, and there's many other sources that talk about this, is basically telling us that the Jews sinned, and we needed some venue of forgiveness. And in other words, the question is, oh, we sinned, we're so bad, does Hashem even like us anymore? Does he care about us anymore? Does he want us anymore? And he says, okay, so now we've got a Mishkan, and the Mishkan comes, so to speak, to show, yeah, God still loves us, and he'll come down and bring his presence into this home. And that shows he still has a connection with us. And he still cares about it, and he still forgives us. But without this Mishkan, without a sin, we wouldn't have needed a Mishkan. That's what the Sephorno says. We would not have needed a Mishkan. So it's almost like a result of the failure of the Jewish people necessitated the Mishkan. Almost like an example. A person's very healthy, and what does he do? He gets very sick, so he now has to go to a rehab center. And the rehab center is necessary because Nebuch, the person got sick. If he wasn't sick, he wouldn't need the rehab center. Well, guess what? The Jewish people got spiritually sick when they sinned with the golden calf, and then now they need a rehab center, and they need this Mishkan. That is the opinion of the Sephorno.
But what about Nam? How is he sick without the rehab center?
It's even worse. You're right. What about now? We sin, and we don't have a Mishkan. So you're right. That's the pain of Gullus. That's Pshat and Gullus lettered. Gullus mean, now even with everything, the sin and the rehab center, they weren't in Gullus anymore, though. They weren't in exile. They were not in exile. But Gullus means you don't have a Mishkan. You don't have the rehab center. It's really bad. That's why Gullus is a terrible state to be in.
So they got the Mishkan because they were still closer to God than Nasser was.
Oh yes. Oh yes. It was still better off than being sent away. Now we're in a state of being sent away. So that's really bad. And the rabbis say the only thing we have now is a shul, is what we call a miniature temple. Not a real one, but a miniature one. That's the only thing we have now. A place to learn Torah, a place where you daven. Those kind of places that are designated as such are like miniature temples. But you're right, we're lacking a lot because of that.
Does Israel have any part, like if you go to Israel, does that symbolize anything closer towards us?
Is Israel symbolize anything closer to this? Not in the
parts of Israel, I don't mean the actual state.
Not in the present state. No. No. So now, that is the Sephorno. Next, we go to Ramban, Nachmanides, 1200s. Sources 6 and 7 says something altogether different. Altogether different. Number 6, the secret of the tabernacle is that the glory which abode upon Mount Sinai openly, God's presence that was there at Sinai, should abide upon it in a concealed manner. We want that magical moment of Sinai to never be lost. And when God's presence was speaking from Sinai, we want to crystallize it and distill it and give it a certain type of permanence. And that permanence is in this tabernacle, this Mishkan. For just as it said there by Sinai, and the glory of the eternal abode upon Mount Sinai, God's presence on Mount Sinai, and it is further written, behold, the eternal our God has shown us his glory and his greatness. That was at Sinai. So it is written of the tabernacle, it says, and the glory of the eternal filled the tabernacle. twice in this verse, and the glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle. Mentioned connection with the tabernacle correspond with his glory and his greatness. Thus Israel always had with them in the tabernacle the glory which appeared to them on Mount Sinai. In other words, there's a way that God had like a photo, an image, an audio, whatever you want to call it, a permanent record of what Sinai was. You ever want to come back to that Sinai experience? You just go into the temple, take a whiff of that experience. Ah, that's how it felt like it was at Sinai. That was the point of the tabernacle. And the Ramban goes on in the next verse and says, God has spoken directly with Israel when giving the Ten Commandments and enjoined upon them through Moses a selection of representative mitzvos, a procedure similar to that imposed by rabbis of old in the case of proselytes who came to the converted to Israel. In other words, the Jews at Sinai were like converts who converted to Yiddishkeit. Israel undertook to do all that he would command them through Moses, and he made a covenant with them on all this. Now they became his people and he their God, as he had stipulated originally with them. He said, if you will hearken to my voice and observe my covenant, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and holy nation. All those steps had come into place. Now they were holy and worthy of a sanctuary in their midst, so that the divine presence should abide among them. This is the crown jewel moment of everything of the redemption of Egypt was all about. A little bit different than the Sephorno. Ramban is saying, this is it. This was the final step. This is the culmination of the entire Exodus process. We are his people. We're a holy people. We got that best connection. We're at Sinai. God says, I want you to always feel that Sinai connection. And that is the purpose of constructing this Mishkan. Mishkan, the word Mishkan comes from the root Shochan, which means to dwell. Means to dwell. And God is dwelling amongst us, just like he dwelled in a very imposing way at Sinai. He dwells now in our tabernacle as well. So the Mishkan is a tremendously happy, successful moment. Kohen Ramban, that was the goal. That's what Hashem wanted for us originally, the whole plan, when Hashem talked to Moses at the burning bush, that the Jews should be his people, go out of Egypt and serve him, and the ultimate realization, manifestation is the tabernacle that you have. Hooray, it's a great thing. It's the culmination of a dream, of a goal. Sephorno says, it's because we were sinners. You can't get as far apart in opinions as these two opinions. And these are great holy people. They know what they're talking about. So you have to understand what is going on over here. So that is one thing we have to think, all right? We're not going to pile on too many questions. Just one other thing we have to discuss over here. There's a piece of Talmud in source number 8 that's very, very important thing to discuss. Okay. Very important thing to discuss. Reb Shmuel Bar Nachmeni said the name of Reb Yochanan. Now, the person in charge of building the Mishkan, his name was Bezalel. That was the person in charge of building the Mishkan, Bezalel. Now, Moshe would tell Bezalel the things that God told Moshe in terms of how to build the Mishkan. It was Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur, who was, I'm trying to remember now, Hur, I think, was the son of Miriam, if I'm not mistaken. Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur was, I believe, the son of Miriam. And Miriam was... who are you talking about? Was Moshe's sister.
Yeah.
So Bezalel is some kind of great, great grandnephew or something like that. So, let me ask you a question before you look. You've got a Mishkan and you got utensils going in there. Okay, what do you think? What do you build first? You got to build something first. What are you going to build first? The utensils, or are you going to build a Mishkan first? Think.
You build a Mishkan because you've got to have a place where to put the utensils. You can't just leave the utensils lying out. They're supposed to be holy.
You're going
to
build a beautiful menorah, let's say. A beautiful menorah. Okay? Now, where do you put it?
That's not.
Do you build a house first, or do you build furniture first? You're moving out of town. You know, you're being told in 4 months you got to live in this place. So get going. So what are you going to do first? Going to build the furniture? You're going to build a house. It seems you're going to build a house first, right? Does it make sense?
Yep.
Build a house first. So let's take a look at what the Gemara says over here. Source number 8. Bitsalel, why do they call him Bitsalel? Was so because on account of his wisdom. Bitsalel, if you look at the word Bitsalel and cut it in half, it's Bitsail, ale. Bitsail means in the shadow of God. That's what Bitsalel means, in the shadow of God. In other words, it's like he knows what God's thinking. He's in his shadow. At the time when the Holy One blessed is, he said to Moshe, go and tell Bitsalel to make, is what Hashem told him in Parshas Kisisa in a couple weeks from now. He said, make me a tabernacle, an ark, and vessels. That's, you see the order? Mm-hmm. Tabernacle, ark, and vessels. Right. Moses went and reversed the order, saying, make an ark, and vessels, and a tabernacle. He reversed it. He told Bitsalel the opposite. Bitsalel said to Moshe, now Bitsalel didn't know that Moshe reversed it. Yes. So Moses, our teacher, as a rule, a man first builds a house and then brings vessels into it, but you say, make me an ark and vessels and a tabernacle. Where shall I put the vessels that I am to make? So he's very respectful. Can it be that the Holy One, blessed be, said to make a tabernacle and ark and vessels? Maybe Hashem said it the other way. Moshe replied, perhaps you are in the shadow of God. In other words, yeah, you know what? You're a pretty smart guy. So obvious question that you have to ask, obvious question is, why in the world did Moshe reverse what Hashem said? How could you do that? How could you do that? Now the truth of the matter is, if you look in Parshas Truma, this Parsha, Hashem says to Moshe, when he says about building, he first says, build the ark, build the vessels, and then build a tabernacle. That's what he told Moshe in this week's Parsha. Build the ark, vessels, tabernacle. When we come to Kisisa, when God tells Moshe again to pick Bitsalel and to build, he then says, build the tabernacle first. And then the utensils. So God himself reversed it. So then how could Moshe change what Hashem told him? Right? And this is now the bottom line. It's okay, now it's time to build. So why does Moshe go back to the original command that God gave in Parshas Teruma? In other words, in Parshas Teruma, God says, Moshe, this is what I want you to do. Then in Kisis, he says, okay, now it's time to get going. Now let me repeat. And now he repeats and he reverses it. And then Moshe comes to Bitsalel and doesn't say as the reversal, but says it the other way, the way God said originally two parshas earlier. So there's a lot of questions. Why does God reverse it to Moshe? Why does Moshe then reverse it back to what was first told, and Bitsalel is able to pick up the difference? What's going on over here?
Well, it's pretty obvious.
What?
The utensils have a much more spiritual appearance than a building.
Well,
so maybe a time frame where they needed some kind of real tight connection to a.
So why is, you know, why does first God say the utensils and then later it says the tabernacle first? So what's going on over here?
They're waiting. Maybe the people are losing it.
Okay. So, good. So there's a big difference conceptually between making the Mishkan first or making the utensils first. If you're making the utensils first, what would be the rationale? Although what Aubrey said and everybody says is logical, it makes sense to build the building first. What could possibly be a rationale to build the utensils first? What could possibly be the rationale? You'd have to say that for some reason utensils are more important than the building.
Sure.
Somehow. So that's a question, but how could the utensils be more important without a sanctuary?
Where are you going to keep them? That's
where are you going to keep them?
Well, you can build temporary.
Sure, that's a big question. So the answer is, and it's an important point, and this is the idea that really the entire universe is a sanctuary. The entire universe, what does Mishkan mean? A place where God resides. The presence of God is comfortable to reside. The truth of the matter is the entire world is capable of being God's sanctuary. And what are the utensils, the vessels? The vessels are a means to use in terms of working on this relationship with Hashem. And we'll talk about those utensils a bit later, what they do. We'll talk about that. But they're the means. And having them outside, you said you have to have the house first and then the thing. But that's assuming, that when we build a house, there's nasty elements. That when we build a house, we build it for protection. But God's house isn't for protection, it's for His presence. So theoretically, His house could be the whole world. If His house is the whole world, then you got a house already. You got a house. So now what do we need? We just need the utensils. Those are the means to connect to God, because Hashem is everywhere. So now you could ask, well, why do I need a Mishkan at all? Well, because you have to have a place to put them every night. Yeah, you have to, okay, we're going to put the Mishkan, we're going to take the Aron and take it to China. We're going to take the candelabra and put it in Syria. I mean, we got to have some focal point in this whole world. Yes, but where are we going to put them every night? We're going to put it, nobody steals it. I mean, it has to have an address. Some kind of a post office box. You know, it's just like a guy doesn't have a permanent address, but he does have to get the mail. So we're okay. I have a post office box, and I go to the bank or wherever they make post office boxes, and I go there, and that's where I collect the mail. But really, I'm working all over the place. I live all over the place. I'm all over the place. But a person wants to make a sacrifice. Can you tell me where the ark is today? Where the altar is today? I don't know. It's got no address. Well, you got to give you an address. And the truth is the Mishkan did move. It moved from place to place to place to place. And wherever the Mishkan is, that's where the address is now.
So if the whole world is a sanctuary, why do they make things like Erevs and things like that? If everything is a seder, is a sanctuary?
If the whole world is a sanctuary, why do we have to construct things such as an Eruv?
Yeah.
Because you'll see. It's a good
What's
question.
An Eruv?
That's a whole, it's a halachic, convention which enables a public property to be transferred into a private domain. So that's a good question. We'll have to hold a few minutes. The answer is coming. It's coming. So that's the idea. That's the idea. And therefore, so we need a place. We can't leave them outside. So, but the essence is the utensils, which relates to the entire universe, because the entire universe is a sanctuary. That's one way of looking at it. If it's the other way around, if you're building the tabernacle first, and then you're building the utensils, it implies that the presence of Hashem is confined to this building. It's limited. You've got to build the Mishkan because that's where the presence of God is found. And how do you relate to the presence of Hashem, which is in this very confined building? It's through the vessels that are the means to relate to the presence which we find in that building. That's the two big differences that are there. And that is why, there's if you look, there seems to be, what's this business of, there's this initial command that takes two parshas. Everything's discussed, all the instructions. All the instructions are there. And then we find in Parshas Kisisa, we repeat the instructions in an abridged form. But we repeat the instructions. God tells Moshe the instructions. He told him once. Now, he says, okay, now, go to Bezalel, not tell him, and now he tells him again what he told him before. I mean, Moshe's got a good memory. He's not going to forget. No matter how long the gap was, he's not going to forget. He told him, he remembers. And so there's a big argument exactly in terms of the order of certain parts. We'll go the simple way like Ramban. But the problem was there was a big interruption between the instructions and the construction of the tabernacle, and that was the sin of the golden calf. The sin of the golden calf.
In between what?
Between the instructions and the construction of the Mishkan. When Moshe's up on a mountain for 40 days, that's a machlok, it's an argument of rabbis. I'm giving you the simple way. It doesn't really matter at the end. I'm giving you the simple way. So God told him up on the mountain, and you're going to build a Mishkan, and this is how you're going to build a Mishkan. So we're going to start. We're going to build the Aron, and we're going to build the utensils. And then we're going to build a building. And that's the way it's going to be. And that's what God told Moshe. Then Moshe comes down. We have all the problems of sin, the golden calf, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks. And then God says, okay, Moshe, we're going to build a Mishkan, but I'm making a few changes. And the changes is, first you're going to build the structure of the Mishkan, and then you're going to build the Aron, and then you're going to build the utensils. And then Moshe goes over to Bezalel, and he says, you know what, Bezalel? Now he reverses on what God said. We'll have to see why in a minute. He reverses and then says, no, we're going to build the utensils, and then we're going to build the Mishkan. And then Bezalel says, no, that's not what God says. Is that what God really said? And he comes back on with that. So
Bezalel was just commissioned to put up the structure, because all the instructions...
To build,
that's all.
To build everything.
No, all the instructions were in the Torah. So he didn't have to worry about that. That would become naturally. The thing is, but he just had to put up the structure.
No. I don't know what you mean when you say the words put up the structure.
Construct the structure.
First of all, he had to make the utensils. He had to make the utensils.
No, but he was told exactly how to make the instructions. Anybody could have done it.
No, that's not true. That's not true. The rabbis say that it was extremely difficult to make these things. The instructions, you could have instructions, but then you have to know how to do it. Like, Aubrey, can you build a car?
No.
I'll give you the instructions. A manual this big. Go build it.
I could.
Yeah, but it would take you a long time, yeah. And you know what? And you probably make a lot of mistakes the first time. Like anybody would, right? You know, and certain things that were, the Torah says it took, you had to be skilled craftsmen. Certain skills had to be involved. You had to know how, weaving and all this kind of stuff. That, nobody had those skills. So you definitely need the blessings of God to succeed in this. And there was great craftsmanship involved here. And the Jews weren't involved in any craft making when they were in Egypt. No. So you needed some divine assistance to get this done. And there's a lot more than we can even discuss, because a lot of the physics involved in building the Mishkan, the building defied the laws of physics.
The ark
and the poles and everything was wider than the dimensions that they were supposed to be put into. Yeah. I don't want to get into a discussion of that, but that's an incredible thing. And there's more than that. You are using wood, gold, and silver, and you are creating an entity that is seeping with godliness. Since when does rocks, gold, and silver make godliness? There's a whole discussion.
Wood, you said.
Wood.
Not rocks. Wood.
Did I say rocks?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Wood, gold, and silver, and copper, and wool, and dyed things like that. Mm. How do you get the divine presence out of that? So you had to be a very spiritual person to be able to make it that it could resonate and have godliness feel comfortable there. So you had to be a very special person. It wasn't just any old Joe. Bezalel was a very, very holy man. He was very young at this time. Just barely bar mitzvah, like, I think less.
Oh, really?
Very young. But God blessed him with tremendous wisdom. So now, so what's going on? So the rabbi says like this. That when God gave the first commandment to Moshe and said, go build the utensils, the ark, the utensil tabernacle, what God was saying to Moshe is, this is the way it should be. This is the theory. We're talking about the best possible scenario. And the best possible scenario is that I have spoken to you at Sinai. The entire world is my world. The entire world is my Mishkan. You now, wherever you look, wherever you go, you will see godliness wherever you walk. Remember, we explained at Sinai, God made people see what they could hear what they could see. Remember we talked about that? That means they could see the godliness that's directing the physicality in this world. They had an immense closeness to God. And now wherever you walk, you are going to feel the divine presence throughout. And now you need a means of doing certain service to God, so these utensils will provide that special effect of the service that you have. And that's why the Torah says, initial commandment, he says, build for me a tabernacle and I will dwell in them. It doesn't say I will dwell in it. It says I will dwell in them. I will dwell in every Jewish person's heart. And the tabernacle is the world. It is the world. And you'll build the utensils. And the utensils will be the means to connect to God and to serve God and do all those things. But, and we'll build a physical structure as an address. And that's the way it should have been. And this is what the Ramban is saying the purpose of the Mishkan was. That we had succeeded so wonderfully in receiving the Torah at Sinai. And wanted to be able to hold on to that moment. And to feel that all the time. And the whole world is God's Mishkan. Yes, it is. But we're going to have one special address for it to put the utensils in. And that place will be constructed in a way that we'll always will feel and reenact that Sinai revelation whenever we go there. And the Ramban is talking what the Mishkan was in theory, the way it should have been. Should have been. Now, we are told by the Zohar that when the Jewish people were at Sinai, and when they got the Torah at Sinai, they had repaired the damage of 2 millennia of history where man had damaged his soul so much by all his sins. And he had now repaired, the Jews had repaired the damage that they had now reached the level of first man prior to his sin. Prior to his sin. They reached that level. And therefore any taint that was residing in the soul of man was removed. And human beings, the Jewish people, were capable of living forever just like first man was capable of living forever. However, after the sin of the golden calf, then they fell off of that level and they went back to the level of Adam, before, after the sin of eating from the forbidden fruit. That's what the Zohar says. So there's a lot of parallels going on over here. And there's a lot of differences. You know, even for first man, let's think about it for a minute. When first man existed, how many things did God command him to do?
Not to eat the tree.
Not to eat the tree. Is that all? Is that all? Anything else? The truth of the matter is there's a big misconception out there. We talk about the 7 Noahide laws. We think that those Noahide laws started with Noah. They didn't. The Talmud deduces from the earliest accounts in Genesis, when God talked to Adam, that he was responsible in 6 of those 7 Noahide laws. The original Noahide laws were Adamite laws. God told Adam, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not adulterate. Thou shalt set up courts to enforce these laws. Thou shalt not curse God. Thou shalt not worship other idols.
Back then, when there was nobody around.
Right in the beginning. Right in the beginning. Adam and Eve. Right in the beginning. In the beginning. Right in the beginning. Before he even told them not to eat from the forbidden fruit. So now, this has got a lot of commands. So what would be the difference? In other words, you know, man, you're capable of doing sins. You're capable of killing. You're capable. You see his own son killed. You're capable of stealing, you're capable of idolatry, you're capable of these things. And then there was one particular sin, he says, don't eat that forbidden fruit. Now there's a big difference in those two categories. God said, don't eat from that forbidden fruit. If you eat from that forbidden fruit, you will irrevocably change your nature as a human being. It will change the nature of the universe. I don't want to get into that whole issue, but God says, you will bring a whole sense of mortality into this world. It will damage your soul in a way that you'll never be able to correct it in an easy fashion.
So what was it necessary to tell him all the Adamite laws?
Because he was capable.
Because if he was perfect then.
He wasn't perfect. He wasn't perfect. But he was pretty good. He's pretty good. But, you know, he was capable of sinning. He could choose to kill. He chose to kill. The rabbis say, but let's say Adam would have stolen. Let's say he would have stolen something. What would have happened? It would have been a sin, and he could have gone done tshuva, and things would have gotten back to where they should be. But if he just would have stolen, it wouldn't have changed who he was. It wouldn't have changed the world. It wouldn't have got him thrown out of Gan Eden. Wouldn't have brought death to the world. In other words, there were certain things you gotta do, and you gotta correct it, and that's it. But the sin of eating the forbidden fruit, that was such a big, big sin. It totally lowers the level of the people. It lowers the presence of God, goes God out of the world. Death comes into the world. Other things, if he would do the other six sins, he'd get punished, but the whole world doesn't have to change. That's the way we understand it. That was the problem. Eating the forbidden fruit, that was the ultimate sin. At Har Sinai, the same thing. The Jews were given the Torah, and they come back to the level of Adam Rishon. First time.
He didn't admit responsibility.
But as a follow-up to that sin, you're right. But it's the kind of thing that the sin was bad, and the fact he didn't do tshuva on it was bad, and that got him out. Other sins, even if he didn't, let's say he killed and he didn't admit it, he wouldn't have got thrown out again. It was bad, but you know, there's certain sins you do that are forgivable. To forgive you. And certain things, it's just, you know, the damage is so great, I can't even forgive you.
Why did God have to put that temptation?
That's another question. I don't want to get into it right now. It's a good question, but, you know, it's part of all our free will choice. You know, there's certain indiscretions that are so bad. You've done such a terrible thing. You can't right the wrong.
Not those seven, though. Those are pretty strong.
But they're forgivable. They're bad. They can represent a temporary lapse in the human being, but that doesn't mean his entire structure is warped. The sin of eating that fruit, what it did was, eating the forbidden fruit, created a change, a permanent change in the nature of the human being, that evil inclination, which heretofore had resided outside the human being, when you eat the Eitz Hadas, now became part of the human being. And that was such a big consequence. Man can't recover from that simply. Anyway, I don't want to get into so much detail on that. I'm just looking at this as a parable.
If he wouldn't have eaten an evil one, it
would have been an interesting scenario. What would have happened? She probably would have died. He would have got another wife.
So he's better first.
We're theorizing. Eve ate from it first, right?
No.
Okay. She goes to Adam. I can imagine. She says, you know, I ate from the fruit. Adam said, what? I ate from the fruit. So now, what does she say? I want you to eat from the fruit too. Now, you know, why did Adam give in if he knew it was so bad? But you know what? You know, he figured, well, if you ate from it and I don't, we'll never be compatible again. We're going to be so different. You know, it's like, you know, you have two religious husband and wife, and the wife says, I'm giving up religion. So you want to stay married to me or not? You want to stay with your God or stay with me? Stay with your God and be lonely, or stay with me and you won't be lonely, but you won't have your God. So he said, okay, I'll eat the fruit.
We never reached that stage.
It's a whole discussion.
At Sinai,
we reached the stage of man before he ate from the tree of knowledge. We reached that state.
How is that possible? Because why did we have to die then? When Hashem died? This is at Sinai.
At that exact point, during those 40 days when Moshe was at the mountain, nobody died and nobody would ever have died of the Jewish people, ever. During those 40 days. When they sin. Now, that golden calf incident is the exact parallel to not eating that forbidden fruit. When Moshe on the mountain, we told you already, God gave him the Ten Commandments and he gave him all the mishpatim. Remember all the civil laws? And, of course, you know, you can't build a golden calf. You can't have any idol worship, right? Now, what would have happened at this point, before they sent the golden calf, if one Jew would have stole a couple bucks from another Jew?
A couple bucks.
What would have happened?
It would have been a sin.
Yeah.
And we would teach him how to do tshuva.
Right.
And he'd be punished. He would do tshuva. And then everything would be fine.
Okay.
And he still will live forever.
But there's one question that comes
up. Wait. That sin, the golden calf, that was the Eitz Hadas. That was the tree of knowledge sin. That's the sin that knocked them way off of their peg, and they went way down to go back to the level of man after his sin. That's what happened.
It doesn't seem the same. I don't understand it, because we say that the real deeper meaning about eating the apple
was Ena wanted to get closer to God.
Okay, Leonard, you're right. And I don't want to, I want to get into it only because that's going to be the topic in 2 weeks. We're going to discuss the holes in the golden calf in 2 weeks. The last class before we go on a little break. So we're going to, Leonard will explain it all. It's a good question, but I don't want to get into that now. I want to save it for its own class. But it's a good question. But the bottom point I want to make, then I'll get to your question. The bottom point is, before they sinned with the golden calf, they were worthy to be eternal people. Just like first man Adam, the whole world was Eden. The whole world was Eden. Wherever you looked, you saw God everywhere. And God says, I want to give that back to you now, Jewish people. I want you to have this. And therefore, the whole world is a tabernacle. These utensils are beautiful means to feel closer to me within this tabernacle of the universe. And we'll have a physical tabernacle as an address. And you know what? And you're going to now use this tabernacle as a place primarily to commune with me, to feel close to me. And you know what? And if you ever do a little sin now and then, you know, the tabernacle will be there for forgiveness too. Will be there for forgiveness too. That was what it was going to be before the sin. Right? Now the sin of the golden calf essentially was a rejection of what happened at Sinai. So it's almost like they, in theory they accepted it, but in reality they rejected it. Right, and it's exactly like eating from the tree of that first tree of knowledge. And now we return back to that state, and now the Mishkan, now God's presence leaves. You've rejected me. It leaves in a manifested way. It becomes more, it's always there, but it's concealed. When it's concealed, we can't tell it's there. I mean, God's presence is somewhere here, but it's concealed. We just have no ability of appreciating it. Okay, so now, the Mishkan now, after the sin of the golden calf, where man now becomes the finite man, that's an irrevocable reality, we now will die like everybody else, and at that point, what does the Mishkan have to become more of? A place of forgiveness. It's more of a place of forgiveness now, because now we're so caught into sin now. We now have brought the Yetzirah back into our essence. Whew, we're going to be sinning a lot. And since we're going to be sinning a lot, we're going to need a lot of atonement. And therefore, what's the most important service in the Mishkan now? The vote of Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur becomes the most important one because we need atonement. And you know what? It'll also be a place where we can feel connected to Hashem. We can feel connected to Hashem. So if that's the case, then what do you have to build first? You have to first build the Mishkan. Because the presence of God is not evident in this world. Now we have to find a very nice, pure place, very secluded, and there we're going to make sure to be very reverent, and we'll hopefully a little bit of that presence will concentrate itself there. Over there we'll have a little bit of that feeling, and over there we're going to do a lot of service to get a lot of atonement for the multiple sins and the distance we are from God. That becomes the change. So that's why in Parshas Truma, when God gives the initial commandment, he says, I want you to build the ark and the tabernacle, because the whole world is already a sanctuary, and then build a sanctuary as an address. And that sanctuary is going to be a place where you commune with God 99% of the time, and for the inadvertent sin that you do, you'll get a little forgiveness there. Then comes the sin of the golden calf. Then God says to Moshe, okay, now it's time to tell Bezalel to build. Remember what I told you there? I'm making a few changes. Let's reverse the order. Because the whole essence has changed because of that.
I thought you said this was, when I asked you about this one, you said it was after the golden calf.
Which was?
When we discussed this Talmud and Brachos, you said it was after
the golden calf. Yes, that is after.
But he says here that he went and he talked about the tabernacle first.
That's right.
But
God
that
told...
was before the golden calf.
Again. What, no, this Gemara is after the golden calf.
Right. So
now what did God say? What did God say?
He said to Moses, go and tell Bezalel to make a tabernacle.
Yes! The tabernacle first, because after the sin,
and before it was the other one.
Yeah, before the sin, the whole world is the tabernacle. The whole world has God's presence. So I can build the utensils first. Right? And then I'll build the tabernacle as an address. as an actress.
So, but why did Moshe reverse it?
Well, oh, we're going to get to that. So now that they sinned, God reverses and say, no, first you have to build a tabernacle because we have no place for the presence of God. We got to build a place to make the presence. Now you have the presence in this little place. Now they'll put the utensils in. Now Moshe reverses it. That we have to answer that still. He reverses it. So we're going to discuss that in a minute. But Milton has to ask a question for a minute.
My question is,
take a little break.
A pretty obvious question. They build this with the golden calf. But surely there must have been some people who have rejected the fact that they want to build the golden calf. I mean,
okay,
seven people in this room.
That's
here.
A great question.
If we have seven people in this room. I assure you, if we had some argument to discuss something so sophisticated as this, we surely would have probably had seven opinions. And maybe Leonard over there rejects all the, you know, all those concepts, and he says, you know what? I don't want to build a golden calf. I'm going to reject
That's an excellent question. We'll discuss it when we discuss the sin of the golden calf.
But that's so important.
Good, and then we're going to give you a whole class on it. You have to be patient.
Milton, they did. There were people.
You have to be patient. We will discuss it. We will discuss it.
All
right?
But then all this is non-relative.
It's all relevant because we all were blamed for it.
But why?
I'm going to explain it later. It's not the discussion for now. Just trust me. Just trust me now. Accept my word that they were all blamed for it.
I don't want to let everyone.
How? We're going to talk about it later.
I'll talk about it later.
I need a whole.
It's such an important
so
issue.
So good. So make sure to not miss in 2 weeks.
We've only had about 5 years of wondering about this.
Okay. Anyway. So now why did Moshe reverse this? Is the next question. Right? So what's going on? So what's Moshe doing? Well, what Moshe does is like this. Moshe understands the way it really should be. The better way is to build the vessels first. That's the ultimate way it should be.
When you talk about the vessels, which vessels are you talking about?
All these things.
There's only a few vessels.
Six
here.
Of them.
Yeah. But is there significance to everyone really?
I'm going to talk about them. If you let me get, I've got all on the agenda.
Sorry.
If I have time, I can get to everything here. I'm going to try my best. There's significance to everything. You're going to see.
Okay.
So Moshe says he reverses that. You know why? Because he wants us to know what the real essence should be. The way it really should be. And of course, you know, maybe practically it's going to be different. But he's
going against the God, the word of the God.
He's not going against what God's saying. You know, Moshe knew what God originally told him first. And God reversed it. But the fact that God originally told him one thing, that means that's something important too, not to be totally forgotten. And the real essence of the Mishkan, the real way it should be, is the vessels first. And that's necessary to connect you to God who fills the universe. Right? And that, you know, practicality, you know, and of course there's a practicality of what, you know, we have to have a place to build it, so we'll put it in, you know, we'll put it in. So Moshe may not have argued that when it comes to the real building, you'll build the tabernacle first. But the essence is that the utensils are so much more important. And the essence is God fills the whole place. And I still think God fills the whole world. And then Bezalel says, Moshe, you know, you're making a mistake. You've minimized the damage of the sin of the golden calf. You gotta remember, Moshe was the great defense attorney of the Jewish people. He always defended the Jewish people. He never, you know, could accept that they were so bad at this point yet. And he says, in spite of the fact that they sinned, you know what? I wouldn't totally lose sight of the fact that maybe we still can come back to that first level. Even though God's telling us to build, maybe the fact that God told us to build a tabernacle first was only a technical point. In other words, there's the essence and the technicals. You know what? Maybe technically, you know, when Moshe hears the reversal, he thinks the reversal is only a technical reversal. In other words, God first owned the essence. The essence was the utensils are the main thing. The world is a tabernacle. And you know what? And we need a place to put them. We need an address. Then he says, okay, now it's time to really build them. You know what? When you really build them, I'll tell you what. Let's build a tabernacle first, only because if it rains, where are we going to put these things? So Moshe figures it's only a technical adjustment. In other words, Moshe himself, and why is God changing his mind? So Moshe was limited. The first time God said, he's telling, this is the essence. The essence is, once everything is built, the essence is the utensils are the utensils for the world, and the tabernacle is secondary. But then, when it comes down to building, that's not the essence, it's just good old pragmatics. I can't build an ark. What if it was going to rain before I get the temple built? Okay, so build the temple first, just so in case it rains, I'll be able to put the utensils in. But Moshe didn't believe there was a whole paradigm shift in the sin. Bezalel says, Moshe, I think Hashem told the reverse, didn't he? So when Moshe was, why did Moshe reverse it to him, though? He said, I want you to know what the essence is. The essence is the utensils, the main thing, and the whole world is God's universe. Yeah, this, then, you know, maybe there's a technical, but when, and then Bezalel says, you know what, even the essence is different now. Moshe, you're wrong. You know what? The sin was so bad, it has corrupted the entire essence of the Jews, and Jews will not see God's presence in this whole world. And it's so bad that not only technically are we building the Mishkan first, but from a spiritual point of view, the tabernacle has to go first, because God's presence is not in the whole world. Moshe couldn't see it because he's the great defender of the Jews. Bezalel could see it because his grandfather was killed in the sin of the golden calf. Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur. His grandfather was Hur. He was murdered by the rabble who wanted the golden calf. So he understood much clearer the negative effects of the sin of the golden calf. And that's why he's saying perhaps God said it differently. Not only in pragmatics, but in reality. So this becomes the big difference. So let's understand. What we call this is like Mishkan A and Mishkan B. Mishkan A is the whole world is God's sanctuary. Go build the utensils, and with those utensils we will connect to God and be a beautiful thing. And also at the end of the day, we need an address to put them away, we'll put them away. And the Jewish people feel so close to Hashem wherever they go, they feel close. And that's what Hashem told them in Parshas Truma and Tetzav, and just do it. Then they go sit with the golden calf. God says, okay, you know, they deserve to be destroyed, but I forgive them, and this, you know what, let's reverse it. But now the whole dimension of the building has changed. Because now, when we look at that Mishkan, we have to look at the Mishkan, it's called the Mishkan Ha'edus. We come to an extra word, the Mishkan of testimony. What's the testimony? That God forgave us. You know, we did such a terrible sin with the golden calf, God would say, get out of here, I don't want to know of you again. So he says, no, you know what, I'll still come, you got to build me a house, and in the house, I'll come into the house there, there'll be one place where we can meet and we'll still have a relationship going. Whereas the nation of the world thought God rejected us. Now the Mishkan serves as a proof, no, he hasn't rejected us, but it ain't the way it was before. And that's why it's reversed in Parshas Kisisa, and indeed in reality it is reversed in terms of construction as well. Now that, and therefore the Sephorno is also right. The Sephorno said, why do we build the Mishkan? Why do we build the Mishkan? Because we had sinned with the golden calf. Right? When we sin with the golden calf, Ramban says it's the pinnacle of our service to God. The answer is, Ramban is speaking before the sin of the golden calf, Sephorno is speaking after the sin of the golden calf. Right? And that's why when, you know, and the biggest proof that the Sephorno, you know, can't be right in essence, because when Mashiach comes, aren't we going to build a tabernacle? When Mashiach comes, and then sin will be expunged. And we won't need atonement anymore when Mashiach comes. Why are we building a tabernacle then? Because it's the ultimate conclusion of our relationship with Hashem in the most beautiful way. So obviously there has to be a tabernacle. So from the Sephora alone, you think we really didn't need a tabernacle. But the answer is yes, of course, but it would have been a worldly tabernacle. And then we would have the small tabernacles and the address. And that's what will happen when Mashiach comes. When Mashiach comes, the whole world will know God. And we'll have a tabernacle for an address of where to put the utensils.
But it would make more sense to say when the Mashiach comes, we'll find the utensils. Not we'll build the tabernacle.
Okay, there's a big question. If we're going to find them, we have to build new ones. It's not so simple.
Because the utensils are the most important part.
Okay, so we're gonna. But the point is, there will be a sanctuary, and it's not going to be as an atonement anymore. That's the point. It will not be an atonement anymore, and that's the point he's bringing across over here. You know. So how does this work? How does this work? So what does this tabernacle do? Now that we have it the way it is, what does it do? So we have the theory. Now that theory is important to know, because one day it's going to come back that way. One day it's going to be the way the Ramban said. When Mashiach is going to come, it's going to be that way again. where the whole world will be the tabernacle. So that's an important reality. But till now, it's not. Till now, we live in a world like the Mishkan that we built. So how did the Mishkan work? So there's a beautiful analogy. Let us say when you take Evan Ezra says this. When you take a good smelling spice, you know, Yom Kippur, it's late in the afternoon, you're getting awfully tired, So what do you start passing the spices around? You notice? A good smelling salt. So what happens? You give a, your whole body wakes up. Even your toes are awake. Right? Right? Now, what if you take that smelling salts and put it right next to your foot? What's going to happen? No. Nothing. Put it next to your arm?
No.
Stomach? Nothing. By your nose? Boom! Everything happens. So what's the analogy to? You walk around in the world now, you know, where's God? I don't know. Is he here? I don't know. I don't sense anything. You come into the tabernacle, which is a very purified environment. You know, only holy things are going on over there. When you go into the tabernacle, it's like that's the nose of the universe. You go in there, it's like you get a good whiff of God. You're able, this, you know, there was a lot that had to be done to make this environment so holy. But when you came in there, any Jew who went in there, they felt something very special. They could feel God was there. Once you feel God's there, then you can go out of the tabernacle and then you can sense he's in other places too. But you gotta get that smell. And that's what the tabernacle was. That's what Yerushalayim was when we built a Beis HaMikdash. That whole point, you know, you work a whole week, a whole year, you kind of think it's you who does it and it's not God. Then you go to the temple, you see all the miracles that happen, you realize, no, there is a God. I sense there's a God. You know what? He must be back home too. Although not as palpable, but he must be there. And that's the function that the Mishkan serves. That's the function that the Mishkan serves for us. And that becomes a big difference. So we got to realize, and that's why there's a lot of talks, so many parshas over here, so much talk over here, because there was the pre-sin of the golden calf type of Mishkan and the post-sin of the golden calf type of Mishkan. And the Mishkans had to relate to different relationships that we had based on that. And those are two relationships we have to know. There's the relationship we have now with God and the relationship that we hope to have later when Mashiach comes. Now, what is it exactly that these utensils are supposed to teach us? So let's look at the picture just so you can have these ideas in front of you. And we're going to give you a couple analysis of this. We're going to give you two ways to discuss it. They're both correct. They're both correct. What do we know? Pirkei Avos says, the world stands on three things. The world was created for doing three things. If we don't do these three things, the world has no purpose. Every human being has to do three things to be able to connect himself to God. What are they?
Kindness.
Kindness is the one pillar.
Service.
Service to God in terms of, you know, what are the ritual things we gotta do with God that can include bringing an offering, prayer, my service to God. The things that God tells me, I wouldn't do it if God wouldn't tell me to do it. But that's the thing that I develop my relationship in the doing part of my life. Right? And the study of Torah. Yeah. Now the doing, we can expand it to call it prayer. Torah, avoda, gemilas chasadim. Torah, prayer, we'll say prayer to make it easier, and acts of loving kindness. Now, we know that the soul, the three lowest levels of soul, the ones we're more in tune with, is called what? Nefesh, ruach, neshama. Nefesh is the part of the soul that makes your physical actions infinite in nature. Ruach is the power that it gives you the ability, it's wind, the ability to speak and to connect to God through speech. And neshama is the part of your soul that gives you the ability to think about God. Those are the three ways you connect to God. Thoughts, speech, and action. You have to have all three. You can't have one, can't have two, you have all three. It has to have the total package. Without that, you can't have a relationship with God. We have a relationship with people. Relationship with your wife, with your friends, you gotta think about them all the time, you gotta talk about them all the time, you gotta communicate with them, you gotta do. Right? There's no question about it. You gotta have all three. So now let's look at the items in the tabernacle. And each one is gonna highlight these activities that we're supposed to do. Okay. Let's start with an easy one. which one would reflect acts of loving kindness? I'll review. We've got the table where you put the showbreads in. We got an altar. And we've got the ark. We got the menorah. We got the inside altar. We got the outside altar. Which one would be an act of loving kindness?
Table.
The table. The showbreads. Because what do you do at a table?
Because you give it to people.
12 breads. I don't need 12 breads. What do I need so many breads for? What is that for? It's to bring blessing to each one of the 12 tribes, that they should have abundance in food. And what do you do when you have abundance? You share and you give. And what's a Jewish table supposed to be like? You're supposed to share and give tzedakah. So it's God's way of bestowing blessings upon us. So we take those blessings and share those blessings with others. The whole service of making the challahs and putting them there and then taking them out and eating them, it's all representing acts of loving kindness. And that whole engagement was a prototype of every other type of loving kindness you do in the world. Okay. What about Torah?
Service.
Okay, let's do service. Okay, we want to do service. Service is the menorah. It's the mizbeach, the altar. But question, wait a minute. How many altars are there?
Two.
See, there should be two. One for the incense and one for the other.
There are two.
But why is it in the drawings that it looks like one?
There's two. One of the incense.
There's two. No, you have to look at the pictures here. The one on the further left is just the Mishkan. The one on the further left is just the Mishkan.
Okay.
The smaller thing. Look over here, Leonard. This part in this picture here is this whole picture here. So the inner area has one altar and the outer area has one. So why do you need two altars for service to God? Why do you need two? What do you mean? Because in service to God, we already learned in the work Chovos Halvavos, duties of the heart, that there's the external things we do in service, and then there's the internal. There's what I do when I serve God and how I feel when I serve God. You put on tefillin today. That's avoda, right? That's service, right? You're doing your service. What are you thinking about when you're putting your tefillin on? If you're not thinking about anything, then you're deficient in your service to God. It's not good enough just to do it. You gotta feel something. So the outer altar, that's representing the outer, external activities of the service to God. Service to God, you know, I'm putting on tefillin. But what about the inner feeling? That was the inner altar, where it's not an animal. On the outer altar, you only brought animals. You brought animals, you brought breads, you brought birds. It's big stuff. The inner one was just incense. What do you get from it? It's just a smell. It's a smell. It's so insignificant compared to the, but that's the thought. That's a thought behind the service. It should be a good smell. When you put on tefillin, you should have a good feeling. You say, I really love you, Hashem. I'm putting on these tefillin because I wanted to get close to you and I love you. And you have to think about it when you bring on tefillin. So you need to have an outer and an inner altar. Because your avoda to Hashem has to be focused, not just doing it, you know, I'm doing it, but I've got to feel what I'm doing. Does that make sense? And that's inside the curtains. That's inside the curtains. Nobody sees, very few people saw that. Not everybody got to go in here, in this part here. Mm-hmm. Just the Kohen Levi. You know, if you were standing here, you could smell the beautiful incense. It went all through Yerushalayim. You didn't see it. It was hidden. It's hidden. There's a hidden part. There's the one that's outside, and then there's the inside. So therefore, that would encourage every Jew, whatever you do to serve God, make sure you do the outer service properly and the inner service properly. And then we have Torah. Now what utensil fits the Torah? The menorah is light. Wait a minute. There's one more utensil we forgot about. The ark. What's the ark? Doesn't the ark have the Ten Commandments in it? Isn't that Torah? Oh, so we have two utensils for Torah. Why do I need two utensils for Torah?
Any reason?
Come on, no, you know it. It's easy. It's very easy. Think of the easiest answer. The easiest. No, easier than that. There's two parts to Torah, the written Torah and the oral Torah. the written Torah, the Oral Torah. Now, which one's which? Which one do you think is which between the two?
Written,
the Ark is the written, because that's something written. Oral, there's really nothing written. We've written it now, but it's what does the oral do? The oral expands our understanding of the Torah. Remember, the Torah written by itself, you can't understand it. You can't understand it by itself. That's the idea of the tablets put in the Ark in a box. You know what? You can't understand it. We can't touch it. You can't change it. Can you change one letter in the Torah? Not one letter. Do you really understand it by itself? I really can't understand it. It's the perfect, unadulterated, not touched by man Torah. It's way beyond what we can understand. So complicated. The oral law, God says, I'm going to explain it to you. I'm going to explain to you what this means, and not only will I explain it to you, but as time passes, you may even incorporate a few of your own ideas within the framework of what I've established. And what does that do? That illuminates.
Why did Hashem?
One second. It illuminates. What does the menorah do? It makes light. The written Torah by itself, you'll be in the dark. If you just read a Bible by itself without any commentary, you're in the dark. You don't even know what it's talking about. You can't understand. You don't even know how to put tefillin on from the written Torah. You don't know how to have a lulav and esrog from the Torah. You don't know anything from the Torah. So now the oral law illuminates it and it expands. And therefore we need two parts to the Torah as well. So now you see how these five utensils, when we work with these utensils, they are the paradigms for everything a Jew has to do in his whole life. Okay. Now, question.
There must be a reason for making the Torah so complicated.
Yes, I'll tell you why. That's a very good question. Why is the Torah so complicated? The answer is because Torah is the blueprint for life. It's the manual for life, and you have to learn.
But it was explained, and then you could do it.
So let me explain to you. So Torah says like this: if you want to understand life, you're going to understand life by the way you understand how you learn Torah. How do you learn Torah? You read the written law and you say, this doesn't make sense. What I see doesn't make sense. So now I have to go to the oral law. The oral law will say, you see what you see? I'm going to make sense out of it for you. It says this and this and this. That doesn't make any sense. I don't understand that.
Give an example.
The Torah says, first of all, many of the stories of the Torah are written in a way we can't really understand. Very simple. If you were reading the Torah, would you know how to wear tefillin? Why? Because the Torah just says, put totafos on your head. What's that? So you say tefillin. What's tefillin? Who's tefillin? What tefillin? How do you make a tefillin? What is a tefillin? It's like 25,000 laws of how to make a tefillin. Where's the laws? How do you know it's a black box? How do you know it's a box? How do you know it's anything? So God said, I'll take this one word and I'll explain it all to you. You can't go anywhere without the oral law. You see this way? I don't understand it. It says on Sukkot you take a beautiful fruit and shake it. What's a beautiful fruit? What's a beautiful fruit? I don't know. An orange. A tomato.
That's where all the controversy comes in.
No, but the point is being, when God gave Moshe the Torah, he said, I want you to know this is what it means. Then why did you write it this way? Because I want you to know things aren't as they appear in life. And the most important lesson of the Torah is that whatever your eyes see, don't believe it. The most important lesson of Judaism is you seeing is not believing. Yes. So God says, I'm going to teach you how to see. That when you will see, you'll know what it really means. And that's the way God had to make the world, because God, the whole point of the world is that we have to learn how to get to the emes, to the truth. And that's how the world works. God concealed himself. The truth is God is everywhere, right? But he did such a good job of concealing himself. God, you don't see God. What do you see? Do you see God? I don't see God. I don't see him. Do you see him? I don't see him.
You see evidence of him.
That's not the same thing. And an atheist sees no evidence of God. Right? I don't see him, but you know what? If I think hard and I dwell and I contemplate and I think hard, I will find him. The whole point of life is to get close to God. You think God makes it that easy? You gotta work on it. It's like hide and seek. You have to look for him. That's what you're here for. So the Torah, which parallels this, so God says, listen, the way you learn Torah, that's the way you have to live your life. You read a verse, I don't understand what it means. So now when you see your friend drive by you and doesn't stop and you offer you a ride, it's not the way you see it. Life isn't the way you see it. You have to judge him favorably. Right? Don't do anything in this world just based on what you see, because your eyes will deceive you. And that's the way you have to learn how to live life.
That's an obvious question coming
right? out. So that makes sense. So now these utensils are a paradigm for life. Use these utensils. So the priests would be the ones that would use it. They would teach us. Say, look how we serve God. Now you apply it in the way that fits for you to serve God as well. The same way we're doing it, you do in the simpler ways of putting on your tefillin and davening and keeping kosher and having a Shabbos table and things like that. Now, I've got just a few minutes, so let me just do one more point and then we can take a question. Let's bring it full circle. So the truth of the matter is, the Mishkan is a paradigm really to everybody's house. And when you're looking to build a house and you're looking to put furniture in your house, the best blueprint is to look how the Mishkan was built. And if you look how the Mishkan is built, you'll see it parallels in many ways how your home should be structured. And this is very practical. Remember, we asked in the beginning, well, what do we need to know about a temporary dwelling for? The truth of the matter is, we all are temporary dwellers in this world. We all have a very temporary dwelling. Wherever you live, you think 7 years is a long time? It's temporary. Because we have to live in this temporary dwelling so we will be able to live in a permanent dwelling forever. And just like the Mishkan was temporary, but it will lead to the Beis HaMikdash, and ultimately the Beis HaMikdash will come when Mashiach comes, will be a permanent thing. So each and every one of us is living in a temporary dwelling in this world. And we have to make the best of it and furnish it in the way it should be furnished so it will enable us to have a permanent existence when we're finished living in this temporary dwelling. So a person's home is like a Mishkan. And we said the Mishkan had two parts, right? Again, you have the inner building and then the outside, right? So the home is divided into two parts. We have the inside of the house and the outside of the house. You have your house and then outside of the house. Now, where was most activity? What would you say the majority of activity, holy activity, where did most activity happen?
Outside.
Right here. This Mizbeach, I don't know how many. Thousands and thousands and thousands of sacrifices every day. Here, okay, you lit the incense offering once. What? The candles once. The showbreads once a week. You never touch the ark. Right? So, but the main activity is outside. So the truth of the matter is, for a Jew, his main activity is outside the house. You gotta go out, you gotta learn Torah, you gotta do acts of kindness, you've got to make a living. I mean, let's be honest, for most people, where does your life take place? Outside of the house. That's where your life takes, outside of the house. When does most arguments in a home take place? When do fights between husbands and wife more often than not? Usually when you're on vacation. Because you're not working. You gotta be extra careful. You know, husbands were working, husband's busy, now it's vacation, let's have a good time, they're together, I'm not saying you have to always fight. But it's more likely. We have fights. So you gotta be careful. But outside is the time to get going on. But there's a certain amount of service that's done inside. So now we walk into a Jewish home, we're going in the front door now. Oh, we got three things. Well, number one, we got the table there. Of course, every Jewish home should have a table. A table where you eat food, where you keep kashrus, you give charity to the poor. The rabbis say that now that we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, your table is like the altar. And that's the places where you do service to God. When you're eating, the whole idea of eating, it's a spiritual activity where you take the physical food and you make it feel you close to Hashem. That we have in our house. Every time you come to the kitchen table, there is a shulchan there. And then we have the menorah, which is the Torah. And what do we know about the menorah? The menorah would shine throughout the entire Mishkan. And the Torah in your house has to be a place in your house where you learn Torah. And the Torah atmosphere permeates every room in the house. Every room in the house. Every room should look like a Torah home. You look at the pictures on the walls. Should be pictures that have real Jewish content. You shouldn't go in a place where there's, you know, art of unclothed people. You know, and that's art. That's not a Jewish home. It's not a Jewish. It's a Goyish home. You have to have a picture of the Kotel, a picture of a holy rabbi. Even if you want to have pictures of grass, of God's nature is nice, flowers. But you don't have these, you know, this modern art, mishigas, disgusting things. It's no place in a Jewish home. Right? You don't have magazines that have things that shouldn't be brought into a Jewish house. So that illumination should go right through the house. Right? The table has its place, but the menorah lights the entire house. Then we have that mizbeach, that altar that has the incense. You can't touch it, but what does it do? It gives a nice aroma throughout the whole building. So what is that nice aroma that comes in your house? That's what we call the shalom bayis, the matrimonial harmony. Well, what did you have? You had 13, the spices were 13 different spices. And one of them was the most foul smell. One of the 13 spices, if you do it alone, was the foulest smell. I think it was the chalbana. And what happens is, but when you put all 13 together, it was the most beautiful smell man could ever smell. What does that mean? You have to be able to take all different aspects and unify them and work together, and it can make a beautiful smell. If anyone goes by itself, it can make the most foul smell. That's what marriage is. If a husband and wife, if everybody wants to do their own thing, you're going to have all kinds of foul smells in that house. They say we have to work as a team. We have to work together. We have children. Every child is part of the team. We're all working for one goal. We have to be unified together. And you're in those kinds of houses. You're in a house where it's mom as you walk in the house. It's mom as you feel like you're in the temple. Even if the kids are running around making noise, but it's in a nice way. They're playing in a sweet, natural way. You could tell when you're in a house that's not a Jewish home. You know, every kid's in his own room playing, blasting his stereo and playing games of killing and this and that on the handheld things. And it's a noisy house, a conflicted house. Everybody's selfish. There's arguments, there's fighting, there's screaming. You know, that's not a utensil. It's an atmosphere. You come to some house, your mom should feel you're in a beautiful atmosphere. Right? What's left? What didn't we talk about? Then there's another curtain in here. In here there's another curtain. And then there's what we call the Kodshei Kodashim, the holiest of holies. Not everybody's allowed in there. Very limited access, just the high priest. Nobody else can ever go in there. There's one place that nobody else can go in there. And what is that in the Jewish home? That is the bedroom. The bedroom is the holiest of holies. Because we know, it says, that there are three partners in the creation of a man, of a baby. A man, a woman, and God. We know that if a man and a woman live in peace, the Shekhinah, the divine presence, dwells in them. And the bedroom is the place where the love and the closest and the oneness and the love for Hashem is felt on every level. And nobody else belongs in there. Nobody else belongs in there. No TV belongs in that room. Nothing. It's just the holiest of holies. And that's why the Yetzer Hara tries to attack the holiest of holies and make it so mundane and dirt and cheap and to take away that beautiful holiness. So every home has every aspect. So the truth is, what we learn in this Mishkan is that's how our houses should be patterned today, in those temporary dwellings. And if we would have a home the way this Mishkan was patterned, then eventually we'll have a Beis HaMikdash. Eventually we'll have a Beis HaMikdash. So that's why it's very, very practical. And there's so many details that we're not going to get into, but all the fine details of the candelabra has the things that stick out, and how the 12 showbreads. There's so much detail, you can go on for years trying to understand it. But on a simple level, this is what Yiddishkeit's all about. This is what a Jewish home is all about. And that's what we have to keep in mind. And that's why God took us out of Egypt. That's why this is the end of the book of the Exodus. When are we really free? When we're free, when we have homes like this, where people know to be charitable and kind and keep the Torah the way it's meant to be and do service the way it's meant to be done and to have a holiest of holies the way it's meant to be holy. That's why God took us out of Egypt. And any Jewish home who is a home like this has their own redemption right now. They are already redeemed right now. There's lots of hope. Everybody can make their home this way. There's nothing stopping you. Even the whole world is crazy. Your home can be. And you have to, yeah, that's why what's so critical is to maintain the sanctity of your home. And you have a shul, maintain the sanctity of your shul. A shul is a miniature temple. So these are the areas that can give us protection in a world that no longer is a temple now. But you still have it in your own home. And that's why the rabbis say, and who is the Kohen Gadol? Who's the high priest of the home? It's the wife. You know, the wife. And women, they feel so bad. Why, what do I do all day? What do I do all day? I clean the house. I change the diapers. I make the meal. I want to ask you, what did a Kohen do? The Kohen is the elite, right? What did they do? They swept the ashes off of the altar in the morning. First thing, all the ashes get swept away. That's a real glorious job, isn't it? 5 o'clock in the morning, everybody sleeps. The Kohen has to get up early. Remember, that altar had to be ready crack of dawn. What about all the garbage from the whole night? They burnt all the fat and the, you know, it's like a massive barbecue. Who likes to clean the barbecue? Is that like a glorified job? And the morning comes, got all the ash, all the garbage, and everybody's asleep, and this Kohen has to get up early and clean the, you know, it's like the mother has to start, get up before everybody else gets up, get things ready to go. They do it 2 weeks ago, but they had other things to do. So what do they do there? They were teaching people Torah. So the wife has to teach them Torah. So, but it's not as glorified a job. And the Kohen Gadol, Leonard, the Kohen Gadol was restricted. He couldn't even leave the Beis Hamikdash. And the wife feels restricted. She can't go out of her house. We don't realize the home is the happiest place in the world. That's the biggest mistake. Where's the happiest place in this world is the Mishkan. The best place you could be all day long. A person doesn't realize the best place you can be, as to quote Dorothy, there's no place like home. It's so Emmaus. There's no place like home. It's the best place. It's the place where the child learns love. It's the place where husband and wife learn to love each other. It's not out in the street. And unfortunately, society says the home isn't worth anything. And if anything, they want to bring the street into the house. And as Jews, we have to fight and maintain that beautiful home that we have. Okay. It's a little taste of that. Okay, next week, we'll go into the clothing. The clothes make the man.